on foot. I think the gentleman you mentioned must be the point she's aiming at, and yet I don't like his living down in her own part of the country neither.
I know so little, said I. There may be someone else nearer here of whom I never heard.
That's true. But whatever you do, don't you fall a cry, my dear, and don't you worry yourself no more than you can help. Get on, my lad.
The sleet fell all that day unceasingly. A thick mist came on early, and it never rose or lightened for a moment. Such roads I had never seen. I sometimes feared we had missed the way and got into the ploughed grounds or the marshes. If I ever thought of the time I had been out, it presented itself as an indefinite period of great duration, and I seemed, in a strange way, never to have been free from the anxiety under which I then laboured. As we advanced, I began to feel misgivings that my companion lost confidence. He was the same as before with all the roadside people, but he looked graver when he sat by himself on the box. I saw his finger uneasily going across and across his mouth during the whole of one long, weary stage. I overheard that he began to ask the drivers of coaches and other vehicles coming towards us what passengers they had seen in other coaches and vehicles that were in advance. Their replies did not encourage him. He always gave me a reassuring beck of his finger and lift of his eyelid as he got upon the box again, but he seemed perplexed now when he said, "Get on, my lad." At last, when we were changing, he told me that he had lost the track of the dress so long that he began to be surprised. It was nothing, he said, to lose such a track for one while, and to take it up for another while, and so on, but it had disappeared here in an unaccountable manner, and we had not come upon it since. This corroborated the apprehensions I had formed when he began to look at direction posts, and to leave the carriage at crossroads for a quarter of an hour at a time while he explored them. But I was not to be downhearted, he told me, for it was as likely as not that the next stage might set us right again. The next stage, however, ended as that one ended. We had no new clue. There was a spacious inn here, solitary, but a comfortable, substantial building, and as we drove in under a large gateway, before I knew it, where a landlady and her pretty daughters came to the carriage door, entreating me to alight and refresh myself while the horses were making ready, I thought it would be uncharitable to refuse. They took me upstairs to a warm room and left me there. It was at the corner of the house, I remember, looking two ways. On one side, to a stable-yard open to a by-road, where the ostlers were unharnessing the splashed and tired horses from the muddy carriage, and beyond that to the by-road itself, across which the sign was heavily swinging. On the other side, to a wood of dark pine-trees. Their branches were encumbered with snow, and it silently dripped off in wet heaps while I stood at the window. Night was setting in, and its bleakness was enhanced by the contrast of the pictured fire glowing and gleaming in the window-pane. As I looked among the stems of the trees and followed the discoloured marks in the snow where the thaw was sinking into it and undermining it, I thought of the motherly face brightly set off by daughters that had just now welcomed me, and of my mother lying down in such a wood to die. I was frightened when I found them all about me, but I remembered that before I fainted I tried very hard not to do it, and that was some little comfort. They cushioned me up on a large sofa by the fire, and then the comely landlady told me that I must travel no further to-night, but must go to bed. But this put me into such a tremble lest they should detain me there that she soon recalled her words and compromised for a rest of half an hour. A good endearing creature she was, she and her three fair girls also busy about me. I was to take hot soup and broiled fowl while Mr. Bucket dried himself and dined elsewhere. But I could not do it when a snug round table was presently spread by the fireside, though I was very unwilling to disappoint them. However, I could take some toast and some hot negus, and as I really enjoyed that refreshment, it made some recompense. Punctual to the time, at the half-hour's end, the carriage came rumbling under the gateway, and they took me down, warmed, refreshed, comforted by kindness, and safe, I assured them, not to faint any more. After I had got in and had taken a grateful leave of them all, the youngest daughter, a blooming girl of 19 who was to be the first married, they had told me, got upon the carriage step, reached in and kissed me. I have never seen her from that hour, but I think of her to this hour as my friend. The transparent windows with the fire and light, looking so bright and warm from the cold darkness out of doors, were soon gone, and again we were crushing and churning the loose snow. We went on with toil enough, but the dismal roads were not much worse than they had been, and the stage was only 9 miles. My companion smoking on the box, I had thought at the last inn of begging him to do so when I saw him standing at a great fire in a comfortable cloud of tobacco, was as vigilant as ever, and as quickly down and up again when we came to any human abode or any human creature. He had lighted his little dark lantern, which seemed to be a favourite with him, for we had lamps to the carriage, and every now and then he turned it upon me to see that I was doing well. There was a folding window to the carriage head, but I never closed it, for it seemed like shutting out hope. We came to the end of the stage, and still the lost trace was not recovered. I looked at him anxiously when we stopped to change, but I knew by his yet graver face as he stood watching the ostlers that he had heard nothing. Almost in an instant afterwards, as I leaned back in my seat, he looked in, with his lighted lantern in his hand, an excited and quite different man. "What is it?" said I, starting. "Is she here?" "No, no, don't deceive yourself, my dear. Nobody's here. But I've got it." The crystallized snow was in his eyelashes, in his hair, lying in ridges on his dress. He had to shake it from his face and get his breath before he spoke to me. "Now, Miss Summerson," he said, beating his finger on the apron, "don't you be disappointed at what I'm a-going to do. You know me. I'm Inspector Bucket, and you can trust me. We've come a long way. Never mind. Four horses out there for the next stage up. Quick!" There was a commotion in the yard, and a man came running out of the stables to know if he meant up or down. "Up, I tell you. Up! Ain't it English? Up!" "Up," said I, astonished. "To London? Are we going back?" "Miss Summerson," he answered. "Back. Straight back as a die. You know me. Don't be afraid. I'll follow the other, by God."
"The other?" I repeated.
"Who?"
"You called her Jenny, didn't you? I'll follow her. Bring those two pair out here for a crown a man. Wake up, some of you."
"You will not desert this lady we are in search of. You will not abandon her on such a night, and in such a state of mind as I know her to be in," said I, in an agony, and grasping his hand.
"You are right, my dear, I won't. But I'll follow the other. Look alive here with them horses. Send a man forward in the saddle to the next stage, and let him send another forward again, and order four on, up, right through. My darling, don't you be afraid."
These orders, and the way in which he ran about the yard urging them, caused a general excitement that was scarcely less bewildering to me than the sudden change. But in the height of the confusion, a mounted man galloped away to order the relays, and our horses were put to with great speed.
"My dear," said Mr. Bucket, jumping to his seat and looking in again, "you'll excuse me if I'm too familiar. Don't you fret and worry yourself, no more than you can help. I say nothing else at present, but you know me, my dear, now, don't you?"
I endeavoured to say that I knew he was far more capable than I of deciding what we ought to do. But was he sure that this was right? Could I not go forward by myself in search of— I grasped his hand again in my distress and whispered it to him— "of my own mother?"
"My dear," he answered, "I know, I know, and would I put you wrong, do you think? Inspector Bucket? Now you know me, don't you?"
What could I say but yes?
"Then you keep up as good a heart as you can, and you rely upon me for standing by you, no less than by Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet. Now, are you right there?"
"All right, sir."
"Off she goes, then, and get on, my lads."
We were again upon the melancholy road by which we had come, tearing up the miry sleet and thawing snow as if they were torn up by a water wheel. Chapter 58. A Wintry Day and Night. Still impassive, as behoves its breeding, the Dedlock townhouse carries itself as usual towards the street of dismal grandeur. There are powdered heads from time to time in the little windows of the hall, looking out at the untaxed powder falling all day from the sky. And in the same conservatory there is peach blossom turning itself exotically to the great hall fire from the nipping weather out of doors. It is given out that my lady has gone down into Lincolnshire, but is expected to return presently. Rumour, busy overmuch, however, will not go down into Lincolnshire. It persists in flitting and chattering about town. It knows that that poor, unfortunate man Sir Leicester has been sadly used. It hears, my dear child, all sorts of shocking things. It makes the world of 5 miles round quite merry. Not to know that there is something wrong at the Dedlocks is to augur yourself unknown. One of the peachy-cheeked charmers with the skeleton throats is already apprised of all the principal circumstances that will come out before the Lords on Sir Leicester's application for a bill of divorce. At Blaze and Sparkles, the jewellers, and at Sheen and Glosses, the mercers, it is, and will be for several hours, the topic of the age, the feature of the century. The patronesses of those establishments, albeit so loftily inscrutable, being as nicely weighed and measured there as any other article of the stock-in-trade, are perfectly understood in this new fashion by the rawest hand behind the counter.
"Our people, Mr. Jones," said Blaze and Sparkle to hand in question on engaging him, "our people, sir, are sheep, mere sheep. Where two or three marked ones go, all the rest follow. Keep those two or three in your eye, Mr. Jones, and you have the flock."
So likewise Sheen and Loss to their Jones, in reference to knowing where to have the fashionable people, and how to bring what they, Sheen and Loss, choose into fashion. On similar unerring principles, Mr. Slattery, the librarian, and indeed the great farmer of gorgeous sheep, admits this very day,
"Why, yes, sir, there certainly are reports concerning Lady Dedlock, very current indeed among my high connection, sir. You see, my high connection must talk about something, sir, and it's only to get a subject into vogue with one or two ladies I could name to make it go down with the whole. Just what I should have done with those ladies, sir, in the case of any novelty you had left to me to bring in. They have done of themselves in this case through knowing Lady Dedlock, and being perhaps a little innocently jealous of her too, sir. You'll find, sir, that this topic will be very popular among my high connection. If it had been a speculation, sir, it would have brought money. And when I say so, you may trust to my being right, sir, for I've made it my business to study my high connection and to be able to wind it up like a clock, sir."
Thus rumour thrives in the capital, and will not go down into Lincolnshire. By 5:30, post-meridian, Horse Guards time, it has even elicited a new remark from the Honourable Mr. Stables, which bids fair to outshine the old one, on which he has so long rested his colloquial reputation. This sparkling sally is to the effect that although he always knew she was the best-groomed woman in the stud, he had no idea she was a bolter. It is immensely received in turf circles. At feasts and festivals also, in firmaments she has often graced, and among constellations she outshone but yesterday, she is still the prevalent subject. What is it? Who is it? When was it? Where was it? How was it? She is discussed by her dear friends with all the genteelest slang in vogue, with the last new word, the last new manner, the last new drawl, and the perfection of polite indifference. A remarkable feature of the theme is that it is found to be so inspiring that several people come out upon it who never came out before, positively say things. William Buffy carries one of these smartnesses from the place where he dines down to the house, where the whip for his party hands it about with his snuff-box to keep men together who want to be off, with such effect that the speaker, who has had it privately insinuated into his own ear under the corner of his wig, cries, "Order at the bar!" 3 times, without making an impression. And not the least amazing circumstance connected with her being vaguely the town talk is that people hovering on the confines of Mr. Slattery's high connection, people who know nothing and ever did know nothing about her, think it essential to their reputation to pretend that she is their topic too, and to retail her at second hand with the last new word and the last new manner and the last new drawl and the last new polite indifference and all the rest of it. All at second hand, but considered equal to new and inferior systems and to fainter stars. If there be any man of letters, art or science among these little dealers, how noble in him to support the feeble sisters on such majestic crutches. So goes the wintry day outside the Dedlock mansion. How within it? Sir Leicester, lying in his bed, can speak a little, though with difficulty and indistinctness. He was enjoined to silence and to rest, and they have given him some opiate to lull his pain, for his old enemy is very hard with him. He is never asleep, though sometimes he seems to fall into a dull waking doze. He caused his bedstead to be moved out nearer to the window when he heard it was such inclement weather, and his head to be so adjusted that he could see the driving snow and sleet. He watches it as it falls throughout the whole wintry day. Upon the least noise in the house, which is kept hushed, his hand is at the pencil. The old housekeeper, sitting by him, knows what he would write and whispers, "No, he's not come back yet, Sir Leicester. It was late last night when he went. He has been but a little time gone yet." He withdraws his hand and falls to looking at the sleet and snow again until they seem, by being long looked at, to fall so thick and fast that he is obliged to close his eyes for a minute on the giddy whirl of white flakes and icy blots. He began to look at them as soon as it was light. The day is not yet far spent when he conceives it to be necessary that her rooms should be prepared for her. It is very cold and wet. Let there be good fires. Let them know that she is expected. Please see to it yourself. He writes to this purpose on his slate, and Mrs. Rouncewell, with a heavy heart, obeys. "I dread George," the old lady says to her son, who waits below to keep her company when she has a little leisure. "I dread, my dear, that my lady will never more set foot within these walls."
"That's a bad presentiment, mother."
"Nor yet within the walls of Chesney Wold, my dear."
"That's worse. But why, mother?"
"When I saw my lady yesterday, George, she looked to me, and I may say at me too, as if the step on the ghost's walk had almost walked her down."
"Come, come. You alarm yourself with old story fears, mother."
"No, I don't, my dear. No, I don't. It's going on for 60 years that I've been in this family, and I've never had any fears for it before. But it's breaking up, my dear. The great old Dedlock family is breaking up."
"I hope not, mother."
"I'm thankful I've lived long enough to be with Sir Leicester in this illness and trouble, for I know I'm not too old nor too useless to be a welcomer sight to him than anybody else in my place would be. But the step on the ghost's walk will walk my lady down, George. It has been many a day behind her, and now it will pass her and go on."
"Well, mother dear, I say again, I hope not."
"Ah, so do I, George," the old lady returns, shaking her head and parting her folded hands. "But if my fears come true, and he has to know it, who will tell him?"
"Are these her rooms?"
"These are my lady's rooms, just as she left them."
"Why now,"
says the trooper, glancing round him and speaking in a lower voice,
"I begin to understand how you come to think as you do think, mother. Rooms get an awful look about them when they are fitted up like these for one person you are used to seeing them, and that person is away under any shadow, let alone being God knows where."
He is not far out. As all partings foreshadow the great final one, so empty rooms, bereft of a familiar presence, mournfully whisper what your room and what mine must one day be. My lady's state has a hollow look, thus gloomy and abandoned. And in the inner apartment, where Mr. Bucket last night made his secret perquisition, the traces of her dresses and her ornaments, even the mirrors accustomed to reflect them when they were a portion of herself, have a desolate and vacant air. Dark and cold as the wintry day is, it is darker and colder in these deserted chambers than in many a hut that will barely exclude the weather. And though the servants heap fires in the grates, and set the couches and the chairs within the warm glass screens that let their ruddy light shoot through to the furthest corners, there is a heavy cloud upon the rooms which no light will dispel. The old housekeeper and her son remain until the preparations are complete, and then she returns upstairs. Volumnia has taken Mrs. Rouncewell's place in the meantime, though pearl necklaces and rouge pots, however calculated to embellish Bath, are but indifferent comforts to the invalid under present circumstances. Volumnia, not being supposed to know, and indeed not knowing what is the matter, has found it a ticklish task to offer appropriate observations, and consequently has supplied their place with distracting smoothings of the bed linen, elaborate locomotion on tiptoe, vigilant peeping at her kinsman's eyes, and one exasperating whisper to herself of, "He is asleep." In disproof of which superfluous remark, Sir Leicester has indignantly written on the slate,
"I am not."
Yielding, therefore, the chair at the bedside to the quaint old housekeeper, Volumnia sits at a table a little removed, sympathetically sighing. Sir Leicester watches the sleet and snow, and listens for the returning steps that he expects. In the ears of his old servant, looking as if she had stepped out of an old picture frame to attend a summoned Dedlock to another world, the silence is fraught with echoes of her own words. Who will tell him? He has been under his valet's hands this morning to be made presentable, and is as well got up as the circumstances will allow. He is propped with pillows, his grey hair is brushed in its usual manner, his linen is arranged to a nicety, and he is wrapped in a responsible dressing-gown. His eyeglass and his watch are ready to his hand. It is necessary, less to his own dignity now perhaps than for her sake, that he should be seen as little disturbed and as much himself as may be. Women will talk, and Volumnia, though a Dedlock, is no exceptional case. He keeps her here, there is little doubt, to prevent her talking somewhere else. He is very ill, but he makes his present stand against distress of mind and body most courageously. The fair Volumnia, being one of those sprightly girls who cannot long continue silent without imminent peril of seizure by the dragon boredom, soon indicates the approach of that monster with a series of undisguisable yawns. Finding it impossible to suppress those yawns by any other process than conversation, she compliments Mrs. Rouncewell on her son, declaring that he positively is one of the finest figures she ever saw, and as soldierly a looking person, she should think, as what's-his-name, her favourite lifeguardsman, the man she dotes on, the dearest of creatures, who was killed at Waterloo. Sir Leicester hears this tribute with so much surprise and stares about him in such a confused way that Mrs. Rouncewell feels it necessary to explain.
"Miss Dedlock, don't speak of my eldest son, Sir Leicester, but my youngest. I have found him. He has come home."
Sir Leicester breaks silence with a harsh cry.
"George! Your son, George, come home, Mrs. Rouncewell?"
The old housekeeper wipes her eyes. "Thank God, yes, Sir Leicester." Does this discovery of someone lost, this return of someone so long gone, come upon him as a strong confirmation of his hopes? Does he think, "Shall I not, with the aid I have, recall her safely after this, there being fewer hours in her case than there are years in his?" It is of no use entreating him. He is determined to speak now, and he does, in a thick crowd of sounds, but still intelligibly enough to be understood.
"Why did you not tell me, Mrs. Rouncewell?"
"It happened only yesterday, Sir Leicester, and I doubted your being well enough to be talked to of such things."
Besides, the giddy Volumnia now remembers, with her little scream, that nobody was to have known of his being Mrs. Rouncewell's son, and that she was not to have told. But Mrs. Rouncewell protests, with warmth enough to swell the stomacher, that of course she would have told Sir Leicester as soon as he got better.
"Where is your son, George, Mrs. Rouncewell?"
asks Sir Leicester. Mrs. Rouncewell, not a little alarmed by his disregard of the doctor's injunctions, replies, "In London."
"Where in London?"
Mrs. Rouncewell is constrained to admit that he is in the house.
"Bring him here to my room. Bring him directly."
The old lady can do nothing but go in search of him. Sir Leicester, with such power of movement as he has, arranges himself a little to receive him. When he has done so, he looks out again at the falling sleet and snow, and listens again for the returning steps. A quantity of straw has been tumbled down in the street to deaden the noises there, and she might be driven to the door, perhaps, without his hearing wheels. He is lying thus, apparently forgetful of his newer and minor surprise, when the housekeeper returns accompanied by her trooper son. Mr. George approaches softly to the bedside, makes his bow, squares his chest, and stands, with his face flushed, very heartily ashamed of himself.
"Good heaven! And it is really George Rouncewell!" exclaims Sir Leicester. "Do you remember me, George?"
The trooper needs to look at him and to separate this sound from that sound before he knows what he has said, but doing this, and being a little helped by his mother, he replies,
"I must have a very bad memory indeed, Sir Leicester, if I fail to remember you." "When I look at you, George Rouncewell," Sir Leicester observes with difficulty, "I see something of a boy at Chesney Wold I remember well, very well."
He looks at the trooper until tears come into his eyes, and then he looks at the sleet and snow again.
"I'll ask your pardon, Sir Leicester," says the trooper. "Would you accept of my arms to raise you up? You would lie easier, Sir Leicester, if you would allow me to move you." "If you please, George Rouncewell, if you will be so good."
The trooper takes him in his arms like a child, lightly raises him, and turns him with his face more towards the window.
"Thank you. You have your mother's gentleness," returns Sir Leicester, "and your own strength. Thank you."
He signs to him with his hand not to go away. George quietly remains at the bedside, waiting to be spoken to.
"Why did you wish for secrecy?"
It takes Sir Leicester some time to ask this.
"Truly, I'm not much to boast of, Sir Leicester, and I should still, Sir Leicester, if you was not so indisposed, which I hope you will not be long, I should still hope for the favour of being allowed to remain unknown in general. That involves explanations not very hard to be guessed at, not very well timed here, and not very creditable to myself. However, opinions may differ on a variety of subjects. I should think it would be universally agreed, Sir Leicester, that I'm not much to boast of." "You have been a soldier," observes Sir Leicester, "and a faithful one."
George makes his military bow.
"As far as that goes, Sir Leicester, I have done my duty under discipline, and it was the least I could do."
"You find me,"
says Sir Leicester, whose eyes are much attracted towards him,
"far from well, George Rouncewell. I'm very sorry both to hear it and to see it, Sir Leicester."
"I am sure you are. No. In addition to my older malady, I have had a sudden and bad attack. Something that deadens,"
making an endeavour to pass one hand down one side,
"and confuses,"
touching his lips. George, with a look of assent and sympathy, makes another bow. The different times when they were both young men, the trooper much the younger of the two, and looked at one another down at Chesney Wold, arise before them both, and soften both. Sir Leicester, evidently with a great determination to say in his own manner something that is on his mind before relapsing into silence, tries to raise himself among his pillows a little more. George, observant of the action, takes him in his arms again, and places him as he desires to be.
"Thank you, George. You are another self to me. You have often carried my spare gun at Chesney Wold, George. You are familiar to me in these strange circumstances, very familiar."
He has put Sir Leicester's sounder arm over his shoulder in lifting him up, and Sir Leicester is slow in drawing it away again as he says these words.
"I was about to add,"
he presently goes on,
"I was about to add, respecting this attack, that it was unfortunately simultaneous with a slight misunderstanding between my lady and myself. I do not mean that there was any difference between us, for there has been none, but that there was a misunderstanding of certain circumstances, important only to ourselves, which deprives me, for a little while, of my lady's society. She has found it necessary to make a journey. I trust will shortly return. Volumnia, do I make myself intelligible? The words are not quite under my command in the manner of pronouncing them."
Volumnia understands him perfectly, and in truth he delivers himself with far greater plainness than could have been supposed possible a minute ago. The effort by which he does so is written in the anxious and labouring expression on his face. Nothing but the strength of his purpose enables him to make it.
"Therefore, Volumnia, I desire to say in your presence, and in the presence of my old retainer and friend, Mrs. Rouncewell, whose truth and fidelity no one can question, and in the presence of her son, George, who comes back like a familiar recollection of my youth in the home of my ancestors at Chesney Wold, in case I should relapse, in case I should not recover, in case I should lose both my speech and the power of writing, though I hope for better things."
The old housekeeper weeping silently, Volumnia in the greatest agitation, with the freshest bloom on her cheeks, the trooper with his arms folded and his head a little bent, respectfully attentive.
"Therefore I desire to say, and to call you all to witness, beginning, Volumnia, with yourself most solemnly, that I am on unaltered terms with Lady Dedlock, that I assert no cause whatever of complaint against her, that I have ever had the strongest affection for her, and that I retain it undiminished. Say this to herself and to everyone. If you ever say less than this, you will be guilty of deliberate falsehood to me."
Volumnia tremblingly protests that she will observe his injunctions to the letter.
"My lady is too high in position, too handsome, too accomplished, too superior in most respects to the best of those by whom she is surrounded, not to have her enemies and traducers, I dare say. Let it be known to them, as I make it known to you, that being of sound mind, memory, and understanding, I revoke no disposition I have made in her favour. I abridge nothing I have ever bestowed upon her. I am on unaltered terms with her, and I recall, having the full power to do it if I were so disposed, as you see, no act I have done for her advantage and happiness."
His formal array of words might have, at any other time, as it has often had, something ludicrous in it, but at this time it is serious and affecting. His noble earnestness, his fidelity, his gallant shielding of her, his generous conquest of his own wrong, and his own pride for her sake, are simply honourable, manly, and true. Nothing less worthy can be seen through the lustre of such qualities in the commonest mechanic. Nothing less worthy can be seen in the best-born gentleman. In such a light both aspire alike, both rise alike, both children of the dust shine equally. Overpowered by his exertions, he lays his head back on his pillows and closes his eyes for not more than a minute, when he again resumes his watching of the weather and his attention to the muffled sounds. In the rendering of those little services, and in the manner of their acceptance, the trooper has become installed as necessary to him. Nothing has been said, but it is quite understood. He falls a step or two backward to be out of sight, and mounts guard a little behind his mother's chair. The day is now beginning to decline. The mist and the sleet, into which the snow has all resolved itself, are darker, and the blaze begins to tell more vividly upon the room walls and furniture. The gloom augments. The bright gas springs up in the streets, and the pertinacious oil lamps which yet hold their ground there, with their source of life half frozen and half thawed, twinkle gaspingly like fiery fish out of water, as they are. The world, which has been rumbling over the straw and pulling at the bell, to inquire, begins to go home, begins to dress, to dine, to discuss its dear friend, with all the last new modes, as already mentioned. Now does Sir Leicester become worse, restless, uneasy, and in great pain. Volumnia, lighting a candle, with a predestined aptitude for doing something objectionable, is bidden to put it out again, for it is not yet dark enough. Yet it is very dark, too, as dark as it will be all night. By and by she tries again. No, put it out. It is not dark enough yet. His old housekeeper is the first to understand that he is striving to uphold the fiction with himself that it is not growing late. "Dear Sir Leicester, my honoured master," she softly whispers, "I must, for your own good and my duty, take the freedom of begging and praying that you will not lie here in the lone darkness, watching and waiting and dragging through the time. Let me draw the curtains and light the candles and make things more comfortable about you. The church clocks will strike the hours just the same, Sir Leicester, and the night will pass away just the same. My lady will come back just the same."
"I know it, Mrs. Rouncewell, but I am weak, and he has been so long gone."
"Not so very long, Sir Leicester. Not 24 hours yet."
"But that is a long time. Oh, it is a long time."
He says it with a groan that wrings her heart. She knows that this is not a period for bringing the rough light upon him. She thinks his tears too sacred to be seen even by her. Therefore she sits in the darkness for a while without a word, then gently begins to move about, now stirring the fire, now standing at the dark window looking out. Finally he tells her, with recovered self-command,
"As you say, Mrs. Rouncewell, it is no worse for being confessed. It is getting late, and they are not come. Light the room."
When it is lighted, and the weather shut out, it is only left to him to listen. But they find that however dejected and ill he is, he brightens when a quiet pretense is made of looking at the fires in her rooms, and being sure that everything is ready to receive her. Poor pretense as it is, these allusions to her being expected keep up hope within him. Midnight comes, and with it the same blank. The carriages in the streets are few, and other late sounds in that neighbourhood there are none, unless a man so very nomadically drunk as to stray into the frigid zone goes brawling and bellowing along the pavement. Upon this wintry night it is so still that listening to the intense silence is like looking at intense darkness. If any distant sound be audible in this case, it departs through the gloom like a feeble light in that, and all is heavier than before. The corporation of servants are dismissed to bed, not unwilling to go, for they were up all last night, and only Mrs. Rouncewell and George keep watch in Sir Leicester's room. As the night lags tardily on, or rather when it seems to stop altogether at between 2 and 3 o'clock, they find a restless craving on him to know more about the weather, now he cannot see it. Hence George, patrolling regularly every half hour to the rooms so carefully looked after, extends his march to the hall door, looks about him, and brings back the best report he can make of the worst of nights, the sleet still falling, and even the stone footways lying ankle-deep in icy sludge. Volumnia, in her room up a retired landing on the staircase, the second turning past the end of the carving and gilding, a cousinly room containing a fearful abortion of a portrait of Sir Leicester banished for its crimes, and commanding in the day a solemn yard planted with dried-up shrubs like antediluvian specimens of black tea, is a prey to horrors of many kinds. Not last, nor least among them, possibly, is a horror of what may befall her little income in the event, as she expresses it, of anything happening to Celesta. Anything, in this sense, meaning one thing only, and that the last thing that can happen to the consciousness of any baronet in the known world. An effect of these horrors is that Volumnia finds she cannot go to bed in her own room, or sit by the fire in her own room, but must come forth with her fair head tied up in a profusion of shawl, and her fair form enrobed in drapery, and parade the mansion like a ghost, particularly haunting the rooms, warm and luxurious, prepared for one who still does not return. Solitude under such circumstances being not to be thought of, Volumnia is attended by her maid, who, impressed from her own bed for that purpose, extremely cold, very sleepy, and generally an injured maid, as condemned by circumstances to take office with a cousin when she had resolved to be made to nothing less than 10,000 a year, has not a sweet expression of countenance. The periodical visits of the trooper to these rooms, however, in the course of his patrolling, is an assurance of protection and company both to mistress and maid, which renders them very acceptable in the small hours of the night. Whenever he is heard advancing, they both make some little decorative preparation to receive him. At other times they divide their watches into short scraps of oblivion, and dialogues not wholly free from acerbity, as to whether Miss Dedlock, sitting with her feet upon the fender, was or was not falling into the fire when rescued, to her great displeasure, by her guardian genius, the maid.
"How is Celesta now, Mr. George?"
inquires Volumnia, adjusting her cowl over her head.
"Why, Celesta is much the same, miss. He is very low and ill, and he even wanders a little sometimes."
"Has he asked for me?"
inquires Volumnia tenderly.
"Why, no, I can't say he has, miss. Not within my hearing, that's to say."
"This is a truly sad time, Mr. George."
"It is indeed, miss. Hadn't you better go to bed?"
"You had a deal better go to bed, Miss Dedlock," quoth the maid sharply.
But Volumnia answers no, no. She may be asked for, she may be wanted at a moment's notice. She never should forgive herself if anything was to happen, and she was not on the spot. She declines to enter on the question, mooted by the maid, how the spot comes to be there, and not in her room, which is nearer to Celesta's, but staunchly declares that on the spot she will remain. Volumnia further makes a merit of not having closed an eye, as if she had 20 or 30, though it is hard to reconcile this statement with her having most indisputably opened 2 within 5 minutes. But when it comes to 4 o'clock, and still the same blank, Volumnia's constancy begins to fail her, or rather it begins to strengthen, for she now considers that it is her duty to be ready for the morrow, when much may be expected of her, that, in fact, howsoever anxious to remain upon the spot, it may be required of her, as an act of self-devotion, to desert the spot. So when the trooper reappears with his,
"Hadn't you better go to bed, miss?"
and when the maid protests, more sharply than before,
"You had a deal better go to bed, Miss Dedlock,"
she meekly rises and says,
"Do with me what you think best."
Mr. George undoubtedly thinks it best to escort her on his arm to the door of her cousinly chamber, and the maid as undoubtedly thinks it best to hustle her into bed with mighty little ceremony. Accordingly, these steps are taken, and now the trooper, in his rounds, has the house to himself. There is no improvement in the weather. From the portico, from the eaves, from the parapet, from every ledge and post and pillar drips the thawed snow. It has crept, as if for shelter, into the lintels of the great door, under it, into the corners of the windows, into every chink and crevice of retreat, and there wastes and dies. It is falling still upon the roof, upon the skylight, even through the skylight, and drip, 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 with the regularity of the ghost's walk, on the stone floor below. The trooper, his old recollections awakened by the solitary grandeur of a great house, no novelty to him once at Chesney Wold, goes up the stairs and through the chief rooms, holding up his light at arm's length, thinking of his varied fortunes within the last few weeks, and of his rustic boyhood, and of the two periods of his life so strangely brought together across the wide intermediate space, thinking of the murdered man whose image is fresh in his mind, thinking of the lady who has disappeared from these very rooms, and the tokens of whose recent presence are all here, thinking of the master of the house upstairs, and of the foreboding,
Who will tell him? He looks here and looks there, and reflects how he might see something now which it would tax his boldness to walk up to, lay his hand upon, and prove to be a fancy. But it is all blank, blank as the darkness above and below, while he goes up the great staircase again, blank as the oppressive silence.
"All is still in readiness, George Rouncewell?"
"Quite orderly and right, Sir Leicester."
"No word of any kind?"
The trooper shakes his head.
"No letter that can possibly have been overlooked?"
But he knows there is no such hope as that, and lays his head down without looking for an answer. Very familiar to him, as he said himself some hours ago, George Rouncewell lifts him into easier positions through the long remainder of the blank wintry night, and equally familiar with his unexpressed wish, extinguishes the light and undraws the curtains at the first late break of day. The day comes like a phantom, cold, colourless and vague. It sends a warning streak before it of a death-like hue, as if it cried out, "Look what I am bringing you who watch there. Who will tell him?" Chapter 59. Esther's Narrative. It was 3 o'clock in the morning when the houses outside London did at last begin to exclude the country and to close us in with streets. We had made our way along roads in a far worse condition than when we had traversed them by daylight, both the fall and the thaw having lasted ever since. But the energy of my companion never slackened. It had only been, as I thought, of less assistance than the horses in getting us on, and it had often aided them. They had stopped exhausted halfway up hills. They had been driven through streams of turbulent water. They had slipped down and become entangled with the harness, but he and his little lantern had been always ready. And when the mishap was set right, I had never heard any variation in his cool, "Get on, my lads!" The steadiness and confidence with which he had directed our journey back I could not account for. Never wavering, he never even stopped to make an inquiry until we were within a few miles of London. A very few words here and there were then enough for him, and thus we came, at between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, into Islington. I will not dwell on the suspense and anxiety with which I reflected all this time that we were leaving my mother farther and farther behind every minute. I think I had some strong hope that he must be right, and could not fail to have a satisfactory object in following this woman, but I tormented myself with questioning it and discussing it during the whole journey. What was to ensue when we found her, and what could compensate us for this loss of time, were questions also that I could not possibly dismiss. My mind was quite tortured by long dwelling on such reflections when we stopped. We stopped in a high street, where there was a coach stand. My companion paid our two drivers, who were as completely covered with splashes as if they had been dragged along the roads like the carriage itself, and giving them some brief direction where to take it, lifted me out of it and into a hackney coach he had chosen from the rest. "Why, my dear," he said as he did this, "how wet you are!" I had not been conscious of it, but the melted snow had found its way into the carriage, and I had got out 2 or 3 times when a fallen horse was plunging, and had to be got up, and the wet had penetrated my dress. I assured him it was no matter, but the driver, who knew him, would not be dissuaded by me from running down the street to his stable, whence he brought an armful of clean, dry straw. They shook it out and strewed it well about me, and I found it warm and comfortable. "Now, my dear," said Mr. Bucket, with his head in at the window after I was shut up, "we're a-going to mark this person down. It may take a little time, but you don't mind that. You're pretty sure that I've got a motive, ain't you?" I little thought what it was, a little thought in how short a time I should understand it better, but I assured him that I had confidence in him. "So you may have, my dear," he returned, "and I'll tell you what. If you only repose half as much confidence in me as I repose in you after what I've experienced of you, that'll do. Lord, you're no trouble at all. I never see a young woman in any station of society, and I've seen many elevated ones too, conduct herself like you have conducted yourself since you was called out of your bed. You're a pattern, you know, that's what you are," said Mr. Bucket warmly. "You're a pattern." I told him I was very glad, as indeed I was, to have been no hindrance to him, and that I hoped I should be none now. "My dear," he returned, "when a young lady is as mild as she's game, and as game as she's mild, that's all I ask, and more than I expect. She then becomes a queen, and that's about what you are yourself." With these encouraging words, they really were encouraging to me under those lonely and anxious circumstances, he got upon the box, and we once more drove away. Where we drove I neither knew then nor have ever known since, but we appeared to seek out the narrowest and worst streets in London.
Whenever I saw him directing the driver, I was prepared for our descending into a deeper complication of such streets, and we never failed to do so. Sometimes we emerged upon a wider thoroughfare, or came to a larger building than the generality, well lighted. Then we stopped at offices like those we had visited when we began our journey, and I saw him in consultation with others. Sometimes he would get down by an archway, or at a street corner, and mysteriously show the light of his little lantern. This would attract similar lights from various dark quarters like so many insects, and a fresh consultation would be held. By degrees, we appeared to contract our search within narrower and easier limits. Single police officers on duty could now tell Mr. Bucket what he wanted to know, and point to him where to go. At last we stopped for a rather long conversation between him and one of these men, which I supposed to be satisfactory from his manner of nodding from time to time. When it was finished, he came to me looking very busy and very attentive. "Now, Miss Summerson," he said to me, "you won't be alarmed whatever comes off, I know. It's not necessary for me to give you any further caution than to tell you that we have marked this person down, and that you may be of use to me before I know it myself. I don't like to ask such a thing, my dear, but would you walk a little way?" Of course I got out directly and took his arm. "It ain't so easy to keep your feet," said Mr. Bucket, "but take time." Although I looked about me confusedly and hurriedly as we crossed the street, I thought I knew the place. "Are we in Holborn?" I asked him. "Yes," said Mr. Bucket. "Do you know this turning?" "It looks like Chancery Lane."
"And was christened so, my dear," said Mr. Bucket.
We turned down it, and as we went shuffling through the sleet, I heard the clocks strike 5:30. We passed on in silence and as quickly as we could with such a foothold, when someone coming towards us on the narrow pavement, wrapped in a cloak, stopped and stood aside to give me room. In the same moment I heard an exclamation of wonder and my own name from Mr. Woodcourt. I knew his voice very well. It was so unexpected and so, I don't know what to call it, whether pleasant or painful, to come upon it after my feverish, wandering journey and in the midst of the night, that I could not keep back the tears from my eyes. It was like hearing his voice in a strange country.
"My dear Miss Summerson, that you should be out at this hour and in such weather!"
He had heard from my guardian of my having been called away on some uncommon business, and said so to dispense with any explanation. I told him that we had but just left a coach, and were going, but then I was obliged to look at my companion.
"Why, you see, Mr. Woodcourt," he had caught the name from me, "we are a-going at present into the next street. Inspector Bucket."
Mr. Woodcourt, disregarding my remonstrances, had hurriedly taken off his cloak, and was putting it about me.
"That's a good move, too," said Mr. Bucket, assisting. "A very good move."
"May I go with you?" said Mr. Woodcourt.
I don't know whether to me or to my companion.
"Why, Lord," exclaimed Mr. Bucket, taking the answer on himself, "of course you may."
It was all said in a moment, and they took me between them, wrapped in the cloak. "I have just left Richard," said Mr. Woodcourt. "I have been sitting with him since 10 o'clock last night."
"Oh, dear me, he is ill."
"No, no, believe me, not ill, but not quite well. He was depressed and faint. You know he gets so worried and so worn sometimes. And Ada sent to me, of course, and when I came home I found her note and came straight here. Well, Richard revived so much after a little while, and Ada was so happy and so convinced of its being my doing, though God knows I had little enough to do with it, that I remained with him until he had been fast asleep some hours, as fast asleep as she is now, I hope." His friendly and familiar way of speaking to them, his unaffected devotion to them, the grateful confidence with which I knew he had inspired my darling, and the comfort he was to her, could I separate all this from his promise to me? How thankless I must have been if it had not recalled the words he said to me when he was so moved by the change in my appearance. "I will accept him as a trust, and it shall be a sacred one." We now turned into another narrow street. "Mr. Woodcourt," said Mr. Bucket, who had eyed him closely as we came along,
"our business takes us to a law stationer's here, a certain Mr. Snagsby's. What, you know of him, do you?"
He was so quick that he saw it in an instant.
"Yes, I know a little of him, and have called upon him at this place."
"Indeed, sir," said Mr. Bucket. "Then you will be so good as to let me leave Miss Summerson with you for a moment, while I go and have half a word with him."
The last police officer with whom he had conferred was standing silently behind us. I was not aware of it until he struck in on my saying I heard someone crying.
"Don't be alarmed, miss," he returned. "It's Snagsby's servant."
"Why, you see," said Mr. Bucket,
The girl's subject to fits, and has had 'em bad upon her tonight. A most contrary circumstance it is, for I want certain information out of that girl, and she must be brought to reason somehow.
At all events, they wouldn't be up yet if it wasn't for her, Mr. Bucket, said the other man. She's been at it pretty well all night, sir.
Well, that's true, he returned. My light's burnt out. Show yours a moment.
All this passed in a whisper a door or two from the house, in which I could faintly hear crying and moaning. In the little round of light produced for the purpose, Mr. Bucket went up to the door and knocked. The door was opened after he had knocked twice, and he went in, leaving us standing in the street.
"Miss Summerson," said Mr. Woodcourt, "if without obtruding myself on your confidence I may remain near you, pray let me do so."
"You are truly kind," I answered. "I need wish to keep no secret of my own from you. If I keep any, it is another's."
"I quite understand. Trust me, I will remain near you only so long as I can fully respect it."
"I trust implicitly to you," I said. "I know and deeply feel how sacredly you keep your promise."
After a short time, the little round of light shone out again, and Mr. Bucket advanced towards us in it with his earnest face. "Please to come in, Miss Summerson," he said, "and sit down by the fire. Mr. Woodcourt, from information I have received, I understand you are a medical man. Would you look to this girl and see if anything can be done to bring her round? She has a letter somewhere that I particularly want. It's not in her box, and I think it must be about her. But she is so twisted and clenched up that she is difficult to handle without hurting."
We all three went into the house together. Although it was cold and raw, it smelt close, too, from being up all night. In the passage behind the door stood a scared, sorrowful-looking little man in a grey coat, who seemed to have a naturally polite manner, and spoke meekly.
"Downstairs, if you please, Mr. Bucket," said he. "The lady will excuse the front kitchen. We use it as our workaday sitting room. The back is Gusta's bedroom, and in it she's a-carrying on, poor thing, to a frightful extent."
We went downstairs, followed by Mr. Snagsby, as I soon found the little man to be. In the front kitchen, sitting by the fire, was Mrs. Snagsby, with very red eyes and a very severe expression of face.
"My little woman," said Mr. Snagsby, entering behind us, "to waive, not to put too fine a point upon it, my dear, hostilities for one single moment in the course of this prolonged night, here is Inspector Bucket, Mr. Woodcourt, and a lady."
She looked very much astonished, as she had reason for doing, and looked particularly hard at me.
"My little woman," said Mr. Snagsby, sitting down in the remotest corner by the door as if he were taking a liberty, "it is not unlikely that you may inquire of me why Inspector Bucket, Mr. Woodcourt, and a lady call upon us in Cook's Court, Cursitor Street, at the present hour. I don't know. I have not the least idea. If I was to be informed, I should despair of understanding, and I'd rather not be told."
He appeared so miserable, sitting with his head upon his hand, and I appeared so unwelcome, that I was going to offer an apology when Mr. Bucket took the matter on himself.
"Now, Mr. Snagsby," said he, "the best thing you can do is to go along with Mr. Woodcourt to look after your Gusta."
"My Gusta, Mr. Bucket?" cried Mr. Snagsby. "Go on, sir, go on. I shall be charged with that next."
"And to hold the candle," pursued Mr. Bucket, without correcting himself, "or hold her, or make yourself useful in any way you're asked, which there's not a man alive more ready to do, for you're a man of urbanity and suavity, you know, and you've got the sort of heart that can feel for another. Mr. Woodcourt, would you be so good as to see to her, and if you can get that letter from her, to let me have it as soon as ever you can?"
As they went out, Mr. Bucket made me sit down in a corner by the fire and take off my wet shoes, which he turned up to dry upon the fender, talking all the time.
"Don't you be at all put out, miss, by the want of a hospitable look from Mrs. Snagsby there, because she's under a mistake altogether. She'll find that out sooner than will be agreeable to a lady of her generally correct manner of forming her thoughts, because I'm a-going to explain it to her."
Here, standing on the hearth, with his wet hat and shawls in his hand, himself a pile of wet, he turned to Mrs. Snagsby.
"Now, the first thing that I say to you, as a married woman possessing what you may call charms, you know, believe me, if all those endearing, etc., you're well acquainted with the song, because it's in vain for you to tell me that you and good society are strangers. Charms, attractions, mind you, that ought to give you confidence in yourself, is that you've done it."
Mrs. Snagsby looked rather alarmed, relented a little, and faltered. What did Mr. Bucket mean?
"What does Mr. Bucket mean?" he repeated. And I saw by his face that all the time he talked he was listening for the discovery of the letter, to my own great agitation, for I knew then how important it must be.
"'I'll tell you what he means, ma'am. "'Go and see Othello acted. "'That's the tragedy for you.'
"'Mrs. Snagsby consciously asked why.
"'Why?' said Mr. Bucket. "'Because you'll come to that if you don't look out. "'Why, at the very moment while I speak, "'I know what your mind's not wholly free "'from respecting this young lady. "'But shall I tell you who this young lady is? "'Now, come, you're what I call an intellectual woman, "'with your soul too large for your body, "'if you come to that, and chafing it. "'And you know me, and you recollect where you saw me last, "'and what was talked of in that circle, don't you? "'Yes? Very well. "'This young lady is that young lady.'
Mrs. Snagsby appeared to understand the reference better than I did at the time.
And Tuffy, him as you call Joe, was mixed up in the same business and no other. And the law writer that you know of was mixed up in the same business and no other. And your husband, with no more knowledge of it than your great-grandfather, was mixed up by Mr. Tulkinghorn, deceased, his best customer, in the same business and no other. And the whole biling of people was mixed up in the same business and no other. And yet a married woman, possessing your attractions, shuts her eyes, and sparklers too, and goes and runs her delicate formed head against a wall. Why, I'm ashamed of you. I expected Mr. Woodcourt might have got it by this time.
Mrs. Snagsby shook her head and put her handkerchief to her eyes.
Is that all? Said Mr. Bucket excitedly. No. See what happens? Another person mixed up in that business and no other, a person in a wretched state, comes here tonight and is seen as speaking to your maidservant. And between her and your maidservant there passes a paper that I will give £100 for down. What do? You hide, and you watch em, and you pounce upon that maidservant, knowing what she's subject to and what a little thing will bring em on, in that surprising manner and with that severity that, by the Lord, she goes off and keeps off, when a life may be hanging upon that girl's words.
He so thoroughly meant what he said now that I involuntarily clasped my hands and felt the room turning away from me. But it stopped. Mr. Woodcourt came in, put a paper into his hand, and went away again.
"'Now, Mrs. Snagsby, the only amends you can make,' said Mr. Bucket, rapidly glancing at it, "'is to let me speak a word to this young lady in private here. "'And if you know of any help that you can give to that gentleman in the next kitchen there, "'or can think of any one thing that's likelier than another to bring the girl round, "'do your swiftest and best.'
"'In an instant she was gone, and he had shut the door.
"'Now, my dear, you're steady and quite sure of yourself?'
"'Quite,' said I.
"'Whose writing is that?'
"'It was my mother's. "'A pencil writing on a crushed and torn piece of paper, "'blotted with wet, "'folded roughly like a letter "'and directed to me and my guardians.
"'You know the hand,' he said, "'and if you are firm enough to read it to me, "'do, but be particular to a word.'
"'It had been written in portions, at different times. "'I read what follows. "'I came to the cottage with two objects.' First to see the dear one, if I could, once more, but only to see her, not to speak to her, or let her know that I was near. The other object to elude pursuit and to be lost. Do not blame the mother for her share. The assistance that she rendered me on my strongest assurance that it was for the dear one's good. You remember her dead child? The men's consent I bought, but her help was freely given.
I came, that was written, said my companion, when she rested there. It bears out what I made of it. I was right.
The next was written at another time.
I have wandered a long distance, and for many hours, and I know that I must soon die. These streets. I have no purpose but to die. When I left, I had a worse, but I am saved from adding that guilt to the rest. Cold, wet, and fatigue are sufficient causes for my being found dead. But I shall die of others, though I suffer from these. It was right that all that had sustained me should give way at once, and that I should die of terror and my conscience.
"'Take courage,' said Mr. Bucket. "'There's only a few words more.' Those two were written at another time, to all appearance almost in the dark.
"'I have done all I could do to be lost. I shall be soon forgotten so, and shall disgrace him least. I have nothing about me by which I can be recognised. This paper I part with now, the place where I shall lie down, if I can get so far, has been often in my mind. Farewell. Forgive.
Mr. Bucket, supporting me with his arm, lowered me gently into my chair.
Cheer up. Don't think me hard with you, my dear, but as soon as ever you feel equal to it, get your shoes on and be ready.
I did as he required, but I was left there a long time praying for my unhappy mother. They were all occupied with the poor girl, and I heard Mr. Woodcourt directing them and speaking to her often. At length he came in with Mr. Bucket, and said that as it was important to address her gently,
he thought it best that I should ask her for whatever information we desired to obtain. There was no doubt that she could now reply to questions if she were soothed and not alarmed. The questions, Mr. Bucket said, were how she came by the letter, what passed between her and the person who gave her the letter, and where the person went. Holding my mind as steadily as I could to these points, I went into the next room with them. Mr. Woodcourt would have remained outside, but at my solicitation went in with us. The poor girl was sitting on the floor where they had laid her down. They stood around her, though at a little distance, that she might have air. She was not pretty and looked weak and poor, but she had a plaintive and a good face, though it was still a little wild. I kneeled on the ground beside her and put her poor head upon my shoulder, whereupon she drew her arm round my neck and burst into tears. "My poor girl," said I, laying my face against her forehead, for indeed I was crying too, and trembling. "It seems cruel to trouble you now, but more depends on our knowing something about this letter than I could tell you in an hour." She began piteously declaring that she didn't mean any harm. "She didn't mean any harm, Mrs. Snagsby." "We are all sure of that," said I. "But pray tell me how you got it."
"Yes, dear lady, I will, and tell you true. I'll tell true indeed, Mrs. Snagsby."
"I am sure of that," said I. "And how was it?"
"I'd been out on an errand, dear lady, long after it was dark, quite late, and when I came home, I found a common-looking person, all wet and muddy, looking up at our house. When she saw me coming in at the door, she called me back and said, 'Did I live here?' And I said, 'Yes.' And she said she knew only one or two places about here, but had lost her way and couldn't find them. 'Well, what shall I do? What shall I do? They won't believe me. She didn't say any harm to me, and I didn't say any harm to her, indeed, Mrs. Snagsby.'"
It was necessary for her mistress to comfort her, which she did, I must say, with a good deal of contrition, before she could be got beyond this. "She could not find those places?" said I.
"No," cried the girl, shaking her head. "No, couldn't find them, and she was so faint and lame and miserable, oh, so wretched, that if you had seen her, Mr. Snagsby, you'd have given her half a crown, I know."
"Well, Gustav, old girl," said he, at first not knowing what to say,
"I hope I should." "And yet she was so well-spoken," said the girl, looking at me with wide-open eyes, "that it made a person's heart bleed. And so she said to me, 'Did I know the way to the burying-ground?' And I asked her which burying-ground, and she said the poor burying-ground. And so I told her I had been a poor child myself, and it was according to parishes. But she said she meant a poor burying-ground not very far from here, where there was an archway and a step and an iron gate."
As I watched her face and soothed her to go on, I saw that Mr. Bucket received this with a look which I could not separate from one of alarm.
"Oh, dear, dear,"
cried the girl, pressing her hair back with her hands.
"What shall I do? What shall I do? She meant the burying-ground where the man was buried that took the sleeping stuff that you come home and told us of, Mr. Snagsby. That frightened me so, Mrs. Snagsby. Oh, I'm frightened again. Hold me."
"You are so much better now," said I. "Pray, pray, tell me more."
"Yes, I will. Yes, I will. But don't be angry with me, that's a dear lady, because I've been so ill."
Angry with her, poor soul.
"There, now I will, now I will. So she said, 'Could I tell her how to find it?' And I said, 'Yes,' and I told her. And she looked at me with eyes like almost as if she was blind, and herself all waving back. And so she took out the letter and showed it me, and said if she was to put that in the post office, it would be rubbed out and not minded and never sent. Would I take it from her and send it, and the messenger would be paid at the house? And so I said, 'Yes, if it was no harm.' And she said, 'No, no harm.' And so I took it from her. And she said she had nothing to give me, and I said I was poor myself and consequently wanted nothing. And so she said, 'God bless you,' and went."
"And did she go?"
"Yes,"
cried the girl, anticipating the inquiry.
"Yes, she went the way I'd shown her. Then I came in, and Mrs. Snagsby came behind me from somewhere and laid hold of me, and I was frightened."
Mr. Woodcourt took her kindly from me. Mr. Bucket wrapped me up, and immediately we were in the street. Mr. Woodcourt hesitated, but I said,
"Don't leave me now."
And Mr. Bucket added, "You'd better be with us. We may want you. Don't lose time." I have the most confused impressions of that walk. I recollect that it was neither night nor day, that morning was dawning, but the street lamps were not yet put out, that the sleet was still falling, and that all the ways were deep with it. I recollect a few chilled people passing in the streets. I recollect the wet housetops, the clogged and bursting gutters and waterspouts, the mounds of blackened ice and snow over which we passed, the narrowness of the courts by which we went. At the same time, I remember that the poor girl seemed to be yet telling her story audibly and plainly in my hearing, that I could feel her resting on my arm, that the stained house fronts put on human shapes and looked at me, that great water gates seemed to be opening and closing in my head or in the air, and that the unreal things were more substantial than the real. At last we stood under a dark and miserable covered way, where one lamp was burning over an iron gate, and where the morning faintly struggled in. The gate was closed. Beyond it was a burial ground, a dreadful spot in which the night was very slowly stirring, but where I could dimly see heaps of dishonoured graves and stones, hemmed in by filthy houses with a few dull lights in their windows, and on whose walls a thick humidity broke out like a disease. On the step at the gate, drenched in the fearful wet of such a place, which oozed and splashed down everywhere, I saw, with a cry of pity and horror, a woman lying. Jenny, the mother of the dead child. I ran forward, but they stopped me, and Mr. Woodcourt entreated me with the greatest earnestness, even with tears, before I went up to the figure to listen for an instant to what Mr. Bucket said. I did so, as I thought. I did so, as I am sure. Miss Summerson, you will understand me, if you think a moment. They changed clothes at the cottage. They changed clothes at the cottage. I could repeat the words in my mind, and I knew what they meant of themselves, but I attached no meaning to them in any other connection. And one returned, said Mr. Bucket, and one went on, and the one that went on only went on a certain way agreed upon to deceive, and then turned across country and went home. Think a minute. I could repeat this in my mind, too, but I had not the least idea what it meant. I saw before me, lying on the step, the mother of the dead child. She lay there with one arm creeping round a bar of the iron gate and seeming to embrace it. She lay there who had so lately spoken to my mother. She lay there, a distressed, unsheltered, senseless creature. She who had brought my mother's letter, who could give me the only clue to where my mother was. She who was to guide us to rescue and save her whom we had sought so far, who had come to this condition by some means connected with my mother that I could not follow, and might be passing beyond our reach and help at that moment. She lay there, and they stopped me. I saw but did not comprehend the solemn and compassionate look in Mr. Woodcourt's face. I saw but did not comprehend his touching the other on the breast to keep him back. I saw him stand uncovered in the bitter air, with a reverence for something. But my understanding for all this was gone. I even heard it said between them, "Shall she go?" "She had better go. Her hands should be the first to touch her. They have a higher right than ours." I passed on to the gate and stooped down. I lifted the heavy head, put the long, dank hair aside, and turned the face. And it was my mother, cold and dead. Chapter 60. Perspective. I proceed to other passages of my narrative. From the goodness of all about me I derived such consolation as I can never think of unmoved. I have already said so much of myself, and so much still remains that I will not dwell upon my sorrow. I had an illness, but it was not a long one, and I would avoid even this mention of it if I could quite keep down the recollection of their sympathy. I proceed to other passages of my narrative. During the time of my illness, we were still in London, where Mrs. Woodcourt had come on my guardian's invitation to stay with us. When my guardian thought me well and cheerful enough to talk with him in our old way, though I could have done that sooner if he would have believed me, I resumed my work and my chair beside his. He had appointed the time himself, and we were alone.
"Dame Trot," said he, receiving me with a kiss, "welcome to the growlery again, my dear. I have a scheme to develop, little woman. I propose to remain here, perhaps for 6 months, perhaps for a longer time, as it may be, quite to settle here for a while, in short."
"And in the meanwhile leave Bleak House?" said I.
"I, my dear? Bleak House," he returned, "must learn to take care of itself." I thought his tone sounded sorrowful, but looking at him I saw his kind face lighted up by its pleasantest smile. "Bleak House," he repeated, and his tone did not sound sorrowful, I found, "must learn to take care of itself. It is a long way from Ada, my dear, and Ada stands much in need of you."
"It's like you, guardian," said I, "to have been taking that into consideration for a happy surprise to both of us."
"Not so disinterested either, my dear, if you mean to extol me for that virtue, since if you were generally on the road you could be seldom with me. And besides,
I wish to hear as much and as often of Ada as I can in this condition of estrangement from poor Rick, not of her alone, but of him too, poor fellow.
Have you seen Mr. Woodcourt this morning, Guardian?
I see Mr. Woodcourt every morning, Dame Durden.
Does he still say the same of Richard?
Just the same. He knows of no direct bodily illness that he has. On the contrary, he believes that he has none, yet he is not easy about him. Who can be?
My dear girl had been to see us lately, every day, sometimes twice in a day. But we had foreseen, all along, that this would only last until I was quite myself. We knew full well that her fervent heart was as full of affection and gratitude towards her cousin John as it had ever been, and we acquitted Richard of laying any injunctions upon her to stay away. But we knew, on the other hand, that she felt it a part of her duty to him to be sparing of her visits at our house. My guardian's delicacy had soon perceived this, and had tried to convey to her that he thought